Hey Alan, it's Jay. Just wanted to thank you for your episodes recently. And I know that you've been talking about doing religion in RPGs and, kind of how that's presented in games. Being that I'm a religious education teacher, a moral philosopher, and, well, generally all-round kind of nerd, I wondered if you actually wanted to have a conversation about it. Maybe because you're talking about like there being podcasters block, and I wondered if maybe getting together and having a chat about it would help unblock. So I'm quite happy if you want to arrange a time sometime to kind of hop online, record it, and yeah, deal with it as you wish. I think I'd enjoy a conversation with you about religion and RPGs. I think it would be kind of interesting, and maybe we'll just bounce off each other. But it was just a bit of a random thought. Make of it what you will, but the offer's there, man. Game on.
All right, so what you just heard was Che Webster calling in, talking about an offer to do a dialogue about religion and RPGs. And I've been talking with him a little bit since that call came in, and we are definitely planning on doing something related to that. But that sort of it's one of those funny things that in some ways I think that Chase Collin has sort of broken open my podcaster's block in some ways, and I thought I would say some things on the subject in a sort of solo episode, this particular episode. And then we could talk further, Che and I together, on the subject, because I think it would be really interesting to talk with Che about a lot of this stuff. His background on the subject, I think, would be is going to be really interesting for discussing a lot of these things, both in the sense that he has been busy teaching religious studies and sort of philosophy and ethics alongside that for some time, as well as his own kind of, well, I think it is without necessarily kind of sharing something that is Chase to share, that he definitely has a different kind of set of his own religious beliefs than I do. And I suppose we may end up talking at least a little bit about that in the dialogue. But anyway, I thought I would do some of what I've been thinking about on the subject now, if nothing else, as a way to lay sort of a foundation for some of that. So anyway, yeah, the sort of two core things that have to do with kind of real world and fictional world, I guess, and these are sort of considerations that relate to the real world and kind of real religions, and considerations that relate to sort of the fictional world and fictional religions. And there's obviously a fair bit of overlap in a number of those places, but that's sort of how I'm going to structure this episode. Is I'm going to start off by talking sort of about real world stuff and then move into kind of fictional world stuff, and we will get into that very soon. All right, so real world considerations. And to me, the real world considerations that exist around religion in RPGs are kind of centrally related to the everybody at the table, right? Depending on the particulars of the game that is being played, there might be other people that it's important to be aware of their kind of feelings and opinions and what they're comfortable with or not comfortable with, as the case may be. But I think that for the most part, excuse me, we're talking about the sort of opinions of everyone at the table in a streamed game that might need to have some consideration of the audience, right? And I think that's one of those things that, in the same way that it, in my opinion, is appropriate to have a some type of like content warning or content awareness if you're going to be having something in the game that would be uncomfortable for some people to be shown, that, you know, you want to... Anyway, but basically what I'm getting at is this idea that I think there is a sort of element of, I hesitate to say comfort, because I think comfort is kind of not quite the right word in some ways, but I also think safety isn't quite the right word either. That I think comfort kind of feels a little bit kind of not enough, and the safety feels too much, if that makes sense. That we're talking about something kind of in between the two that has very much to do with comfort, I think, is all right, because I think one of the things that goes into comfort is the idea of, well, there are a number of pieces, but one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about with regard to comfort has to do with the experience of discomfort and the way that that changes a lot of behaviors, right? We know from kind of development of research around a whole number of things related to like psychology and human behavior and all of that sort of stuff, that, for instance, discomfort often makes it more difficult for people to make decisions rationally in a lot of ways, right? That being uncomfortable can basically make it more difficult to kind of respond like rationally to criticism and things like that. And I've been thinking a lot about that with regard to the concept of shame and the way that I think that shame and the discomfort associated with shame is a kind of major factor in a number of people's decision-making in a lot of ways, and the way that being ashamed of something can not necessarily cause, but can sort of make it more likely that people will respond irrationally to the source of their shame, is something that I've been thinking about a lot for a number of reasons. In particular, there was just to kind of get off topic a little bit, there was a thing I saw on Twitter that was a excerpt from an article that was talking about people that were really annoyed about machines that asked you basically how much you would like to add as a tip at the counter, that, you know, at the coffee shop, it'll say like, you know, okay, you paid with a card, how much would you like to tip on your purchase? And part of the point of that is that, as people pointed out in the comments on Twitter, that what these people who were annoyed about that were largely annoyed about was not the machine itself, but the way in which having the machine right there where the person who is going to receive the tip can see what number you have clicked on, means that you have to basically look the person in the eyes who is going to receive the tip, right? That the barista or whoever can see exactly how much you decided to tip them. And that therefore what these people were responding to was not necessarily, well, was basically the sense of shame that came from having to face the person that would be receiving the tip, and that as a result they were getting kind of mad at the machine instead of mad at like the Starbucks corporation that is, you know, paying below minimum wage on the argument that, well, the baristas can make it up in tips, and that would be a more kind of rational response. And the idea being that irrational response is partly driven by the feeling of shame around the situation, right? Anyway, so basically what I'm getting at has to do with the way that it can be more difficult to respond rationally to criticism or issues or whatever else in certain situations, partly based on feelings of discomfort associated with shame. And I think that ties in to the sort of religion talk, because I think that that is one of the kind of core things that can make people uncomfortable. It has to do with criticism of a historical version of something that they believe in now, for lack of a better term. One of the obvious ones being discussion of, for instance, like Christianity in the medieval world around the time of the Crusades versus Christianity as it sort of presents itself now. And that obviously there are still people today who very much believe in the various kind of things that some of which was put down back in medieval times in some ways, you know, various elements of faith that were kind of laid down back then in some ways versus elements that are, for lack of a better term, more modern. And it seems to me that that's sort of one of the core things that would cause people to be uncomfortable is, you know, for instance, if you are running an RPG world that is based on medieval Europe and there's crusades going on, it feels like that is a criticism of Christianity that might make people who are themselves Christians uncomfortable, right? That's sort of the idea. Anyway, and that is a complicated thing. Jason, in his original podcast episode on the subject of religion in RPGs, talked about how, in his opinion, Christianity is relatively okay to criticize in most of the West, in the First World, and all that sort of stuff. I'm going to push back on that a little bit and say that, in my opinion, it's not so much Christianity that gets criticized as it is hypocrisy masquerading as Christianity that gets criticized, which is to say that I am of the opinion that a whole lot of the criticism is not at all about, you know, the various tenets of Christian faith, and is much more about the way in which, especially in the United States, evangelical conservatives will use their religion as a means of justifying certain political positions, and that part of the point of that is that I think there are a couple of things that kind of come from that. One of them is that, in my opinion, there's a sort of there's a term in trial law, and I can't remember what it is called, but it basically refers to the idea that anything that you bring into the trial becomes fair game for both sides. And I think it has a lot to do with the idea of kind of discussion of a person's character, that basically if the defense in the trial brings in discussion of the person's character, then it is okay to it's okay for both sides to talk about that. But if the defense doesn't bring it up, then the prosecution is not allowed to kind of start their discussion on that front, is the idea. So it's sort of agreed to before the trial generally, but that it has to do with the idea of kind of you know, what you bring into the discussion becomes fair game. And I think that, in my opinion, is a major source of a lot of the kind of what I think is sometimes perceived as criticism of Christianity, that it has, in my opinion, a lot less to do with criticism of Christianity as a system of faith, and a lot more to do with criticism of hypocrisy and the way in which faith becomes something, a tool for manipulative ends in certain hands, basically. And that's sort of what is being got at with that discussion. And that sort of gets into another kind of major issue, which has to do with kind of another thing that I've been thinking a lot about, of in-group cohesion, and the idea being the sort of value placed on in-group cohesion, especially when group cohesion comes up against certain other issues. So the obvious case being, like, what do you do when your buddy does something that they should be criticized for, right? Does something where, you know, ethics is pointing one way and group cohesion is pointing the other. And I think that that becomes a central issue when talking about religion, because group cohesion has so much value placed on it, especially often by people of faith. And that's not an attempt to criticize that behavior at all. That I think has a lot to do with the value that a lot of people who are themselves believers get out of this idea of the community, the community of the faithful, the flock, however you want to describe it. And the way in which there is something really meaningfully positive for a lot of the people who consider themselves members of the in-group, with regard to that sort of concept of, you know, group cohesion, right? That you know, they're a part of your group if they're a part of your religion, right? And that is a interesting thing that I may not be as sensitive to, and so I don't mean to kind of criticize that by any means. So I really do think that that's a positive that comes out of that, but it does, I think, create its obvious issues. You know, as with almost anything that doesn't necessarily have a lot of, you know, if you get into any group where the sort of membership in the group is largely defined by a person kind of saying that they're a member of the group, then I think that can become an obvious issue. I mean, in the same way that a lot of the various things like, I think that this has been a major issue for certain kind of political movements and the like, is the way that, you know, if there's no kind of requirement for membership, for lack of a better term, that what you end up with is, you know, everybody is involved, and that can be plenty beneficial, right, when you're trying to build a broad coalition, but it's not necessarily beneficial if there are kind of various disparate elements. Anyway, so what I'm getting at has to do with this idea of comfort and group cohesion and criticism and all of that sort of stuff, and basically how people feel about their group, especially if their group comes up for potential criticism. And since so many of these games are kind of built on worlds that are based on medieval worlds, and especially medieval Europe, it seems like that becomes a important factor, right? So I guess the ultimate big thing is that I think that as with most things, my kind of answer is just, you know, talk to your group about what they're interested in and comfortable with, right? Trust that your players are kind of self-aware enough to, or that the game master, whoever is involved in the group, is kind of self-aware enough to describe what they are going to be comfortable with and what they're not going to be comfortable with fairly effectively. And that, you know, if issues come up where people are feeling like maybe they, you know, said they would be comfortable with something and then it turns out they're not, or if there are things that seem to sort of push the boundaries, that, you know, be prepared to discuss that sort of thing, I think is at the core of my kind of, that's sort of my solution for most things, right? Is the idea of, you know, trust that everybody at the table is going to be willing and able to talk about their kind of opinions and preferences and all of that sort of stuff. But I think it is a good thing to follow here. I think also one of the big things that I will get into is to emphasize the ability to separate sort of historical information from present day information or present day situational bits. And I think that for me comes down to the idea of, you know, for instance, a modern Christian is, in my opinion, not at all necessarily beholden to the, you know, medieval beliefs about Christianity that are central to the, you know, the Crusades era, right? That, you know, they don't have to agree that Pope Urban II was a good person who was totally right. And I think that emphasizing that ability to kind of choose your group is an important element that, you know, I think that's one of the places where group cohesion becomes such an issue, is basically because people feel like they, you know, have to stick with the group in some ways. And I think there is another option in some ways that, you know, anyone who, you know, it perfectly fair for someone to say, you know, well, that person doesn't represent my beliefs. And I think that can be kind of easier for me in a number of ways, partly because of my particular beliefs, but certainly I have done that with regard to atheism plenty of times, that, you know, somebody, you know, especially in certain corners of the internet where, for whatever reason, the atheists kind of get together and decide they're going to act like tools. And it's like, man, that dude's not part of my tribe. That's, you know, that doesn't represent me, you know, as opposed to, you know, reading, you know, Pascal Quignard's The Roving Shadows. And it's like, yeah, dude is part of my tribe. I hate music too. That's a joke, because one of Pascal Quignard's books is called The Hatred of Music. And The Hatred of Music and The Roving Shadows are, in my opinion, two of the finest pieces of nonfiction ever written. They're both incredible books, totally worth checking out if you have the chance. But what I'm getting at has to do with, I think, the certainly in a lot of my games, I would hope that everyone would be willing to kind of talk through the various issues that they might have around kind of representation of religion, and especially kind of implicit criticism of religion, alongside kind of any of the other things that people might value very strongly, right? I mean, for example, you know, how are people going to feel in a sort of Robin Hood game that is basically about how the, you know, the peasants are getting exploited, and takes a kind of distinctly Marxist, you know, false consciousness turn, right? How that, I think, could be totally upsetting for some people. I would hope that it wouldn't be you know, a deal breaker for the people that I like to play with. But I think the point being is, you know, being kind of willing to talk about those things before they become issues is a sort of central part of how I see as of what I see as kind of the right way to deal with those sorts of things, right? In the same way that I think that it is very different to talk about a house rule before it becomes an issue versus after it becomes an issue, that, you know, if you know, the player rolls the dice and then the GM says, oh, we actually play this a little differently, that's very different than if the GM at the beginning of the session says kind of, hey, this is something that you should bear in mind as you make decisions in the game. And anyway, I don't necessarily have a great kind of overarching point beyond talk to everybody involved and be willing to kind of discuss what everybody's going to find enjoyable and not find enjoyable. And like I said, I think there are some important points about, you know, being able to sort of separate the discussion in the fiction from the sort of discussion in real life and the way in which kind of you know, in the same way that kind of, you know, evil in the fiction doesn't have to be representative of anything particular in real life, the same way that, you know, Nabokov can write Lolita and not be a Humbert style, you know, pedophile, right? That there's the level of authorial separation is, I think, important for, especially when you get into kind of exploring more sensitive topics and more topics that require more subtlety to engage with, right? And a lot of the kind of historical issues around religion and theology, I think, are exactly fit into those categories, right? That you end up with benefiting from a lot of kind of subtlety and clarity in that discussion, and that, you know, working to make sure that everyone at the table, and another element of that is that not everybody at the table may be interested in all of that, right? Plenty of people, I think, are, you know, play games just for sort of, I hesitate to say mindless fun, but for kind of, you know, we're going to, you know, kick down the door and kill the goblins and take their treasure and watch the numbers get bigger sort of thing. And that's totally fine too. And, you know, in games, those sort of players are probably not as suited to a game that is about, you know, like the validity of Holy War as a concept or anything like that. Right. And you know, that there's a real point there about kind of tailoring your particular, as the GM, tailoring what you expect to kind of bring into the game to what the players are actually interested in with regard to their gaming. Anyway, so I don't know if there is a kind of central thesis beyond kind of, you know, make sure that everyone at the table is comfortable with what's going on and be willing to kind of discuss it. But I think that's a good enough place to start at the very least. All right. The other side has to do with sort of the fiction and kind of considerations around religion in RPG worlds within the fiction of the RPG world. And I think this is a place where there are some meaningful considerations that have often a lot to do with the idea of kind of how the world works, essentially. And a big element of this being essentially that, you know, the sort of consideration of, and not every game needs to have this, but a consideration of sort of the function of the world, the way that the fiction operates sort of beyond the what the players can see, right? Beyond what's happening kind of on screen directly, and the way in which the sort of functioning of the world off screen is kind of an extrapolation of what happens on screen. And that this is, I think, important for certain types of games, I guess is the way to put it, that I don't necessarily think this is important for every game. I think there are definitely games where, you know, like I said, you know, kick down the door and take the goblin's treasure type things are totally fine to play. But I think it is worth considering that, you know, there are games where, you know, especially like in a sort of sandboxy world where part of the idea is that there's stuff happening beyond the players, right? That, you know, everything is going on kind of outside of what the players can see, that I think that makes it important to have things kind of work while the players aren't there, right? And the role of religion, and especially when you talk about D&D clerical magic, is I think really important there, that you know, for example, to what degree are like plagues and things like that issues in your particular fantasy world, if, you know, everyone who has cleric levels is able to cast a cure disease with a little bit of prep. And I think that's kind of an interesting question, right? Is that, you know, well, so a plague that spreads relatively slowly, if it can be caught in time, is probably not going to be as much of an issue. But a plague that is, you know, spreading more quickly than, and especially if the particular kind of civilization or society kind of doesn't understand the value of like sanitation practices, that would be an obvious thing, right? I mean, historically, a number of our modern ideas about sanitation kind of came out of response to the Black Plague in a number of ways, that we basically went, oh yeah, it would be a good idea to not you know, just leave the trash out where everybody is gonna get infected by, you know, people's detritus and literal crap and all that sort of stuff, right? That, not to say that every society that existed before the Black Plague did not believe in sanitation, but there is a real kind of development that occurs historically on the basis of that historical experience. And I think that's a kind of interesting place to get at kind of interesting things that you can do with RPG worlds, in essence. So anyway, another consideration that seems kind of obvious is like, are there atheists in fantasy worlds where, you know, everybody can tell that clerics are, you know, calling upon divine power, right? That seems like one of the sort of core arguments for atheism in the real world has to do with, you know, whether or not the various miraculous things that are supposed to have recorded to have taken place actually took place, right? That, you know, if you don't believe in the various miraculous things that apparently happened, then according to certain texts, that you're a lot less likely to believe in the various religions that kind of make their case in part based on these miraculous events, right? That's a sort of important point. And there's a number of other, I think, you know, with regard to clerical magic, one of the obvious questions for me has to do with like how accessible it is, how kind of many clerics there are, in the world, especially kind of depending on the type of game you're playing, because obviously there are sort of different types of games, which is to say that I think a lot of the sort of OSR games put more emphasis on the idea of sort of a world of characters where like classes and levels are just how things work in this world versus a lot of more kind of new school games that may not kind of do that sort of thing, essentially, that, you know, levels may be something that are, you know, this is how the players as kind of exceptional members of this world work, but that's not necessarily how kind of everything works in this world, if that makes sense. And that sort of leads into, I think, what is going to become considerations, right? Is that if you're in a world where, like, you know, yeah, everybody who accumulates a certain amount of experience gets a class level, then, you know, how many clerics are there of whatever level? And if you have the explicit, you know, spell lists for clerics, then you end up with sort of an obvious question about, okay, well, you know, how much how common are a lot of these things, right? And this is something that I think a lot of versions of D&D have to contend with a little bit, right? Matt Colville has a really good video where he talks about the idea of the sort of post-apocalyptic in fantasy. And he makes a point that I think a number of people have made over at various times, that in essence, the kind of default setting for a lot of D&D stuff is sort of dependent upon this kind of post-apocalyptic element, that, you know, one of the ideas is that there was this kind of, you know, civilization that was, among other things, a whole lot better about making magic items than modern civilization, and that therefore it is, you know, easier to go into the dungeons, the ruins of this ancient civilization that made all this awesome stuff, and try to take it from those ruins than to, like, just, you know, work hard to build your own magic items, right? That, you know, and you know, a lot of kind of OSR sort of games, I think, emphasize that in a number of ways, that, right, that, you know, if the random treasure lists include magic items, but it takes like a 10th level wizard to actually create a magic item, that's a pretty serious distinction, right? That you're not going to, you know, you're much more likely to end up with magic items that your characters have found, as opposed to magic items that your characters have crafted themselves. And different games kind of operate in a different way within that kind of framework, right? Because some of them have a lot more emphasis on creating magic items, right? Especially, I think, some of the more new school games where there's sort of an expectation of kind of crafting as a part of the game in some ways, that, you know, you end up being able to make useful stuff like magic items much more easily and much earlier. For instance, in Pathfinder 2, there are some elements like that that I think that, you know, part of the expectation has to do with player characters having access to magic items. And one of the ways that they can get access to the sort of magic items they want is by developing their crafting skills, right? And so that's kind of a whole thing within the framework of the game. Along those lines, I think there is a sort of question about, you know, why does the divine work the way it does? That is sort of an obvious question. And the sort of, in the real world, we would probably call this an issue of theodicy, which theodicy is the problem of evil, essentially. And the idea being that this is sort of a classic theological and philosophical question of essentially, well, you know, within a sort of Judeo-Christian tradition, this often comes up as, you know, if God is all-powerful and all-knowing, why is there evil stuff, right? Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people if God is sort of in control of all this stuff, or could be, right? Because that's sort of the question. And this is not necessarily an easy question to answer in a lot of ways, right? This is a meaningful philosophical and theological issue that has had different answers in different periods and by different thinkers, right? But I think in a, you know, in an RPG world where the divine is a reality, this becomes a major consideration, right? Of okay, well, why do the good gods let bad stuff happen, basically? And this sort of becomes an important issue, right? And how involved are they? Are there rules about their involvement? All of that sort of stuff, right? Are there rules about how often the good gods can get involved in things, or are there, you know, and especially, you know, okay, so what about the chaotic deities, right? Why do they care about all of these rules if they're chaotic, right? That seems to, you know, kind of break the logic a little bit, right? If part of the idea is that, you know, you have lawful deities that believe in the laws and chaotic deities that don't necessarily believe in the rules or the underlying structure or whatever, then kind of how does that manifest? And doesn't that sort of benefit the chaotic deities a lot more than the lawful ones, and make the lawful ones into, you know, as I think the term that I've heard before is lawful stupid, to refer especially to paladins who are, you know, so concerned with kind of upholding whatever particular virtue it is that they praise it to the point of making kind of stupid decisions, right? That's a sort of question. Anyway, and I think this is all kind of things that I don't know that every player is going to think about this stuff, but certainly I have thought a fair bit about a number of these things in various situations while gaming. And I think there's some other, from the perspective of a GM and what you can use, I think there are a couple of other things that I think about, and one of them has very much to do with using particular elements of kind of examples, historical examples, I guess I would say, although they're sort of historical mythological because they're historical in the sense of coming from a particular historical place and period, but also kind of the mythology of that place and period, right? But for example, in the case of like Greco-Roman classical mythology and especially Greek mythology, Roman mythology is a little weird because it a lot of people end up being like, oh, the Romans just, you know, totally copy all this Greek stuff. And it's like, well, sort of, but they also sort of have their own thing going on originally that they end up kind of shifting away from in some ways. And there's some odd stuff that goes on there. And it's a complicated thing that, you know, for instance, Mars, the Roman god who is often conflated with Ares in a sort of original form, has a whole lot to do with agriculture. And we don't know a whole lot about kind of what Mars has to do with agriculture necessarily beyond an association with it that kind of persists in a very kind of sort of simulacrum going forward, where, you know, nobody knows kind of what the meaning is or hasn't recorded what the meaning of this is, just recorded the association. But there seems to be something interesting there about the kind of Roman thought around kind of like population and food production and kind of military might, right? That is kind of an interesting distinction. In the same way that early on in kind of the Roman pantheon, there's this, the kind of original, there's these kind of triads that are an important feature of kind of Roman mythology. And one of them, the sort of early version, involves a sort of triple structure of Jupiter, or I guess Jupiter in Latin, because they don't have J's, and Mars and Quirinus. And we know very, very little about this kind of particular phase of Roman religion beyond that detail. And in particular, we know almost nothing about Quirinus as a deity, but we do know that Quirinus was important enough that one of the seven hills is the Quirinal, and the Quirinal hill is named for Quirinus, this deity, that we know very, very little about the nature of Quirinus as a deity. And so there's something kind of fascinating there about this kind of particular deity. But there's a lot of other stuff. I mean, for instance, you know, a lot of the kind of Germanic mythology that we have by way of sort of Norse mythology, one of the things that a lot of people kind of don't realize as much is that by the time that most of that was written down, it was sort of a kind of conservative backlash to Christianity in some ways to write all that stuff down, that a lot of what we have about kind of Norse mythology in text comes from Snorri Sturluson, who lived in Iceland. And in particular, by the period that he was writing, Iceland had been legally Christianized in the sense that was the sort of, I hesitate to say state religion because that's a little bit different, but that basically the expectation was that everybody was Christian. Now, there's plenty of overlap, especially when you get into kind of particular versions of medieval Christianity that existed. But part of the point is that Snorri Sturluson kind of wrote all this stuff down in part because he felt like it was kind of done, right? That particular era of mythology was over. And he, I think it is fair to say, was not necessarily a completely impartial observer on his own kind of time and his own kind of thoughts around these kind of mythological elements. In particular, one thing that a lot of people don't know is that this kind of Norse mythology went through a number of sort of phases in some ways. And in particular, by the time that the various Scandinavian countries were Christianized, they were not worshiping Odin nearly as much. They were specifically, there's a particular deity that we know almost nothing about, that the Old Norse word translates as the dragon. And we know very, very little about this deity, the dragon, but we know that it was really important for a period kind of after the sort of Odinic Norse mythology and before sort of Christianized Scandinavia, but we have so little of that material that we just don't know what it was like. And what I'm sort of getting at, I've gotten way off topic because I've gotten into having fun talking about mythology instead of making a point about game world religions. But I think there is a real point about kind of the depth of real world mythologies that a lot of people don't kind of have a whole lot of experience with. And then basically that gives you places that you can steal from, right? That in essence, that all of these things that, you know, anything as a GM that your players don't know the source of, they are likely to I sort of default to you as the source. And so in the same way, right, the whole, you know, good artists borrow, great artists steal, right? Just, you know, steal stuff. And I think it would be fun to talk more about some of these things in particular. I would really like to talk about a couple of books by an author named Georges Dumézil, who is a really fascinating kind of comparative mythologist who wrote some really interesting stuff about kind of Indo-European mythology and had a really kind of fascinating approach to Indo-European mythology that was sort of trying to kind of like reverse engineer mythological structures based on a sort of pseudo-Jungian kind of mythological perspective in a sense. And there's some really interesting stuff that he comes up with that very much gets into the kind of, you know, not necessarily verifiable, but it would be awesome if it was true, that I enjoy so much, that I have said before that I think that, you know, at times academia gets terribly worked up over verifiability before truth, and that is fair, but that's less fun. You know, you look at like Herodotus, right? In Herodotus's histories, he will say things like, yeah, I wasn't there to see this particular event, but my brother-in-law had a dream about it. Let me tell you what happened. And the point being that that's a totally different perspective than a sort of modern academic perspective that is totally built around the idea of verifiability, and that there's something kind of interesting that has been lost there, even if verifiability is definitely important. Anyway, all of that is to say, but in order to do something kind of in as much depth about Georges Dumézil, I would need to do some research. So I'm not going to try to talk too much about his ideas today, but I think it would be really interesting to do an episode kind of talking about Gods of the Northmen and Camillus and the three, I don't remember what he calls, but he's got a sort of trilogy that's like the path of the warrior, the path of the sorcerer, the path of the king, I think are the three. And they're sort of about this idea of kind of roles within mythological structures and the sort of relationship between kind of demigod heroes and the divine and all of this other stuff too. And that kind of brings back to one of the things that I wanted to say about Greek mythology, which is to say that in Greco-Roman mythology, the Olympians are not necessarily always on the same side on a lot of issues, but, and this sort of goes back to what I was talking about before, they definitely believe in the value of group cohesion, that, you know, an attack, as Rorschach says in Watchmen, an attack on one is an attack on all of us. And part of the point being that, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, Apollo and Artemis may butt heads with Mars and Aphrodite all the time, but when it come, I guess it should be Ares and Aphrodite, right? May butt heads all the time, but when it comes down to it, right, it's you know, close ranks and fight against the enemies, be that Titans or whoever else. But that also gets into, I mean, a lot of people don't know very much about the kind of Orphic mysticism that became really important to Greek mythology in a sort of similar way as this kind of, you know, transition to Norse mythology happened. And there's a lot that you could pull from there. And anyway, I guess what I'm getting at is that I think that you can do some really interesting things with in world mythologies, partly by kind of utilizing the example of historical mythologies, especially some of the kind of subtle detail that is often lost in the sort of transmission to a sort of pop culture mode of understanding, right? You know, the some of the interesting stuff, you know, like the relationship between Apollo and Dionysus that is central to Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy, right? That you could do something really interesting with that. And especially one of the things that a lot of people don't know about, because it's a fairly minor myth that doesn't get talked about a lot, is, right, so most people in their discussion of Greek mythology understand the idea of kind of, you know, the way that sons kill their fathers, right? That the first kind of parent in Greek mythology, or the first father in Greek mythology, is Uranus or Uranus, who gives his name to one of the planets, obviously. And that Gaia, the earth, is the mother, and Uranus, the sky, is the father, and gives birth to the Titans. And Cronos, the father of the Titans, ends up killing his father, Uranus, and castrates him, and where his, depending on the version, either where his cut off genitals, or where the blood that has fallen from the wound, or other versions, falls into the sea, there is a growth that springs up that is Aphrodite or Venus, depending. And then Zeus does something very similar to his father Cronos. Well, what people forget about is that the sort of process isn't done, and it isn't talked about a lot, but Apollo is fated to do something similar to Zeus. That and there is a physical reality to some of this stuff, that at least in one period, there was a belief that the sickle that Cronos used to chop off his dad Uranus's balls fell into the sea near Sicily, and that it actually like is in a particular bay near historical Syracuse, and that Apollo, when the time comes, is going to basically go to that bay and pull this sickle out from the ocean floor and use it to chop off Zeus's balls and sentence him to an eternity in Tartarus as well. And that's something that is very kind of, I think, different than a lot of kind of sanitized versions of Greek mythology that come to us through pop culture, right? That, you know, the idea of Apollo, you know, finding this sickle on the ocean floor and using it to castrate his father is definitely not something that you're going to find in Percy Jackson. Is that the name of the kind of YA series about Greek mythology? I think so. Anyway, the point being that I think there is a lot of stuff to be drawn from the kind of engagement with the sort of real kind of historical nitty gritty of a lot of these mythologies that will add to gaming world mythologies. So yeah, I hope that was interesting and useful to you guys. As with a lot of my less kind of thoroughly planned episodes, I kind of feel like it's likely that a lot of the stuff that was sort of useful in this particular episode is essentially the sort of stuff that I didn't plan as much, that the kind of, you know, discussion about like queerness and the Quirinal Hill and all of that is probably more interesting and useful in a lot of ways than some of the stuff that I had sort of partially planned, because I feel like that's kind of what often happens with my sort of partially planned episodes, that the partially planned stuff is sort of the framework to hang the kind of actually interesting digressions on, as opposed to the really kind of more heavily planned stuff that I feel like often that's the result of me having like a specific thing that I want to talk about that is itself kind of worth talking about in a lot of ways. So anyway, hope that was interesting and useful to you guys. Big thanks to Che Webster for calling in and kind of giving me a bit of a kick to, push me to work on something like this, because I had fun talking about it. And I, you know, it's one of those classic things. It's, you know, it's nice to get a little bit of a boost from a buddy on working on a project that you may have not necessarily lost interest in, but have kind of lost a bit of momentum on. You know, we all need help with momentum at times. And yeah, so that's just one of those things that happens. Anyway, so I hope that you guys enjoyed this episode. Hope everyone is doing well, staying safe, staying healthy, and having lots of fun gaming. I think I'm going to try to put out an episode on Thursday, although it's a little bit iffy. I've had some kind of health issues recently. I will talk about that in Thursday's episode if it comes out, but if not, it may be a little bit longer as I kind of work on kind of getting back up to speed, essentially. But anyway, I hope you guys, I know you guys can be perfectly patient while I work on my particular issues, because you guys have been patient historically while I work on various issues. So yeah. Anyway, all of that is to say, thank you so much for listening. I've been Arlen Walker. I've been Life Repellent's Wasteland, and I will see you next time. Take care, everybody.